Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we'll be talking with Mr. Mike Crandall. He is the CEO of Digital Beachhead, a leading cybersecurity firm based in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Mike, thanks for your time this morning, and let's go ahead and get started, please.
Hey, no worries. Good to be here.
Yeah. Mike, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I've done over 160 podcasts, and I usually look up the LinkedIn profiles of all my guests, but with your profile, I was really blown away by it with how much you've done. I mean, with the military, teaching, getting all your certifications, and running your own business, and I think you got a couple of other things going on. I'm just really kind of in awe by that. But anyway, we did look up your bio. We did a little bit of snooping on you on Google, but how did you get to where you're at today, and can you tell us the highlights of your career, like in the military? Were you involved with cybersecurity there also? Just all the details.
Yes.
I'm really interested.
Yeah, it started off, I went to college for political science. I was going to be a lawyer. Thought that would be end goal when I first started in high school. That's all I wanted to be, was a lawyer. Fighting for the rights of the underdogs and that kind of stuff. I watched a lot of lawyer TV shows in the 80s. So I went to school, and after I graduated undergrad school, I was just burnt out from school. You know, you kind of get to the point where you're like, I'm just done. So I was like, I'm going to join the military for 4 years, you know, maybe see the world, and then I'll come back to it. And when I joined the military, I signed up to be a computer operator, which –
okay.
In 1990 meant I was running paper tape and mainframe systems and those kind of things to start. And PCs were just breaking out. And I had the misfortune. I broke into a PC of my boss, my NCO in charge, because he got a new PC, and they had paid some money to put on it. This is pre-Windows. So they paid some money to put like a Windows-esque file on the computer, which was just a batch program. So if you hit Control C, you stop the batch program from running, and you had a DOS prompt. And I had taken some computer programming classes in college, so I kind of was somewhat computer savvy, you know, more so than most, I think, you know, in 1990 in the military. And so I created a file on his WordStar that said he was hacked. I ended up getting in trouble. They gave me a letter of reprimand, and it went up to our commander. And the commander basically said, you know, we paid $50,000 to have this, you know, computer software program, and you hacked it. What did you do? And so he had me boot in his computer, and I controlled C, showed him I had a DOS prompt and known his box. And he ripped up my letter of reprimand and told me I was then going to school to learn how to become a small computer guy. And that started my path away from law school and into cyber. That was in 1991, right after the Gulf War. And so they sent me to Microsoft schools, Cisco schools, Novell school. I was building the first networks for the Air Force. And then it just kept growing. And after my 4 years, what they kept doing is every 4 years when it was time for me to re-up or get out, and, you know, I had my first choice. Am I going to go back to law? You know, am I going to go to law school, or am I going to continue this computer thing? I was really enjoying all this new technology, new computer stuff. So they promised me more classes. So at the end of 4 years, we're like, if you stay in, we will send you two. So I got my first MCSE. I got my first Novell certifications and training, and, you know, just kind of all of a sudden 4 years turned into 20. And along the way, we developed the Barrier Reef program, which is the idea of having a firewall switch router that creates a DMZ. So we created the term DMZ, and the whole idea of having a DMZ. That ended up going and getting pushed out to the entire, not just the entire Air Force, but the entire DOD. And then later on after that, we decided we needed to consolidate everyone's firewalls and everything. Every base had their own configs and doing their own things. So we developed the first NOSC, Network Operations and Security Center, at Ramstein as a test project. And then that got adopted out into the Air Force and DoD. And then finally they sent me home. I was in Europe 12 years, bouncing around Europe 12 years doing networking. And then, I came in during the first Gulf War where we were literally running cables across the desert by strapping a reel of cable, thin net, to someone's back. And we'd run point to point to create a network. I was in Bosnia, Kosovo, the northern no-fly zone, where we protected the Kurds in the north. And in those days, networking wasn't, we were just beginning networking, so if we needed to get on a computer or do computers, we had to get to the computer themselves. And then, like I say, after 12 years, they sent me home, and I was put in charge of the Air Force Satellite Control Network here in Colorado. So we managed the network that manages all the networks that connect to the satellites in space. So the satellite control network has networks that sit upon it, such as GPS and weather and all those kind of things, with ground stations around the world. And so I was put in charge of securing that network. So I did that for the last 8 years. During that last 8 years, the Air Force decided that the computer operator wasn't really a good term, because we decided that there was a cyber, which is more offensive, defensive, warlike capabilities. And then there was IT, which was keeping your email running, the actual infrastructure stuff. And so we developed, and I helped write and create the career field for the Air Force cyber career field, helping develop curriculum and that kind of stuff down at Keesler. I deployed to Afghanistan in 2008. That was a pretty rough deployment, so I came back a little broken and decided it was time that I needed to punch. So when I hit 20, a little after 20 years, in 2010, I pulled my golden parachute and retired, and did what most military people do when they retire, is we got a contract job. I went to work for a contracting company that worked for the DoD, because that's what I knew. Did that for 5 years. After 5 years, or during the 5 years, the company was bought twice. Kept getting bought by bigger companies. And on the third buyout, I didn't make the buyout. I worked my way up from a technical writer to a director of operations, and they already had a director of operations, so I was furloughed, let go. And that was when I was like, well, I have a choice. I can work for another contracting company, or I can finally just take the plunge and start my own business. And that's when Digital Beachhead got started.
Excellent. Wow. Okay. So is Digital Beachhead pretty much your own creation?
Yes, the term was Digital Beachhead is a term I coined when I was in the military. I was writing my performance report. You kind of submit your own ideas for a performance report, and your boss, approves it, signs off on it, and they got to the command, and they were like, why does he say he secures the digital beachhead for, space? And I had to go and explain that digital is everywhere, and unlike your traditional beachhead, they are thinking of Marines and Army, holding a line. Us IT guys, us cyber guys, were holding the line, but our line was everywhere. And they thought that was kind of cool, so they let me keep it in my performance report as a statement. And a matter of fact, they then used it in a performance, an awards package for the base, for the wing, which they won. I'm not saying they won because of that one line, but, they did win. And then 2 years after I had it in my EPR, my performance report, the Undersecretary of Defense used it in a speech where he said the enemy had created a digital beachhead on our networks, because there was a hack. And when I realized the undersecretary had used it in a speech, I went out and bought an LLC with the name just so I could know I had it for one day when I retired. And I held on to the LLC until 2015 when I actually went to an S Corp and started Digital Beachhead as a company. Excellent. So we're service disabled, veteran owned small business, and I thought that would help me get some nice government contracts. So
congratulations.
I took the plunge.
Thanks once again for all your service. Yeah, that's incredible. Wow. Now how long have you guys been in business? Is Digital Beachhead just you, or do you have other employees? How big is your company?
We have mostly 1099 contract employees that kind of come and go as the work comes and goes, because we're very project-based. We do have 6 full-time employees. We have offices here in Colorado. The president of the company is located in Virginia, in the D.C. area. And we just opened an office in London, Ontario, Canada.
Oh, wow. Okay. Excellent. Now, apart from being in Canada, do you have a presence in other countries as well, given all the contacts you've had in the military?
What's that? I'm sorry. Say that again, please.
Does the Digital Beachhead have other – do you have a presence in other countries as well, given your tour of duty, you know, with the military, the contacts that I'm assuming you have overseas?
We do some work out of U.S. Forces Japan. For the government there. It's the U.S. Department of Defense, but we do some work for the USFJ, U.S. Forces Japan. So we have 2 employees full-time in Japan.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Now, let's get down to your business. Who is the typical customer base you're trying to target? Look at your website, and it seems like you're pretty much focused on the SMB market. Is that the case, or you're going after more like Fortune 500 or the government contracts? Kind of like anybody could work for you.
Yeah, I mean, we can do work for anyone. What I tried to do and what my thought was is I wanted to take everything I've learned from working at the federal level and the federal government, all their rules and controls and mindset towards security, and somehow make it affordable for the small to mid-sized market, because I think they're the ones being left behind. Your Fortune 500 companies have the money to hire standout cybersecurity teams. Some do, some don't, but you know they do have the resources to do that. Where your small to mid-sized businesses, they have great IT teams, but their IT teams are that. They're IT. They're not necessarily cyber. They are meant to keep the lights on, keep the email flowing, keep the servers running, you know, your typical IT services. And that's not to say they don't know about cybersecurity or have some skill set in that regard. But, you know, if you're treading water trying to keep the email running, you don't really have the cycles in hours to, you know, really delve into the cybersecurity. So we like to go in and provide that oversight, that advice, and direction to those kind of companies, and make it customizable so that they can afford it.
Okay, excellent. Now, I'm at your website right now, and let's do a deeper dive into your product and service offerings. Do you focus pretty much on the VCSO lines, the CMMC lines, or is there anything else that you do also along with that?
What I like to do is I always say, you know, we try to be customizable. So for me, the virtual CISO allows a small to mid-sized business to have us there as a partner throughout the year. So it spreads the cost out. It spreads our workload out, you know, so it's not like we have to fit everything into a 30-day project. So it's kind of win-win for everyone. And as part of that virtual CISO offering, we offer a lot of the skill sets that we can provide kind of a la carte. If you just wanted us to come in and, say, do a pen test against your company, we do penetration testing, vulnerability testing. We can give you a quick cyber audit just to kind of tell you where you are running that against NIST or HIPAA or, you know, whatever governance you need to have followed. So we we kind of focus on that virtual CISO only in so much as that we want to not just kind of come in, do it, and leave. You know, we want to really be your partner and work with you through your life cycle with a minimum 12 months. But we think people come in. For the CMMC, this is a new government. It's a new government kind of requirement from the DOD mandating that any people that work with the Department of Defense have to pass a minimum standard. And we've been fortunate enough to be selected as an auditor so we can go out and audit those government companies to the standard that the government's going to set up. There's going to be five levels of maturity.
Now, Mike, I've written a ton. I've got some clients that are heavy in CMMC, and I've written a ton of stuff on the CMMC in terms of articles, blogs. In fact, one client, a couple of months ago, I just finished a 20-page white paper. The CMMC, it's still confusing for people. Is it still as, not to say backwards, but is it still not where it really needs to be yet? Because I've been reading a lot where people just don't know what's going on, and it's not really where it's meant to be yet. Is that correct, or what are your thoughts on that?
That's exactly where I think we are. CMMC started as an idea, as most things in the government do. You know, and the idea was we need to know that people who are supporting the Department of Defense have some sort of standard of cybersecurity, because we all are becoming more hyper-aware of the importance of cybersecurity. But with any standard, you have to set it. You have to develop it. You have to, you know, determine what you want that standard to be. So when anything new, there's pains and growth. And the DOD set forth and said, we want to hire and develop an advisory board, a CMMC advisory board, which they've done. So that board has gone out using NIST 800-171 kind of as a standard, as the beginning baseline, and developed these five maturity domains that they expect all DOD contractors to follow. The problem is then the DOD comes back, albeit with pressure from small business, pressure from large business, pressure from within as to what the standard should and shouldn't be, and they change their mind. They say, well, maybe this control, maybe not that control. How many assessors should go out to do an assessment? You know, should we limit or should we dictate the number, or should the companies dictate the number? And that's kind of where we are now in the growing pains. So when the DOD set up the advisory board, now they're working back and forth to kind of work through those struggles and those ideas and those determinations. And then, of course, in the middle of all this, we had a change in administration. And anytime you have a change in administration, people within the DOD, your civil servants and stuff get moved around and change jobs. And so that also took place. So the short answer is, yes, we're not there yet. We're going to get there. I don't think they're giving up on CMMC. You know, some people have thought that maybe they'd just drop it. I don't see them dropping it, but it is TBD, to be determined what the final look will come. They have just as an accreditor, we are what they call a third-party certified professional auditor organization. It's 3CPAO, which I always laugh because it's a I think it's a throwback to Star Wars. Someone's getting clever with their acronyms, which is a military guy we did all the time. So I think that's funny. But effectively, we've been selected as a candidate, but we're not approved yet. And the reason we're not approved is they're going through all the candidates and they're assessing us. The DOD is coming through and assessing our organization. And so they have just started that process. So we've had two 3CPAOs approved last month. And we're being told in our meetings with the board that that's going to start moving forward. They're going to start to approve us.
Oh, wow.
The next step after that is they're going to have to approve assessors then. So then we have to hire certified assessors to our organization. and they're working that now to get a curriculum and make sure the DoD passes it. And so the ball is rolling. I think it's just rolling slower than people hoped or thought it was going to. Again, if you've worked with the government, you know, they usually come out of the gate screaming, this is going to happen. It's going to happen now. Everyone be ready. It's happening. Well, and then the government is the government. And they're like, okay, well, what we meant was we need to figure this out. Eventually they get there. It's just never on their normal timeline.
Right, right. Well, what does it take to become an auditor? I've heard different stories where it's like $50,000 expense to become that. What does it take to become an auditor?
To become an auditor, to become the 3CPAO, is not expensive in the upfront cost, in the sense of what do we have to pay the board. I think our cost was $2,000 to $3,000 for our you pay a yearly fee, and so part of that was the yearly fee, and part of that was the application fee. That being said, the company has to get to level 3 maturity, and that's where the expense comes in. So depending on the size of your company, it could cost upwards of $50,000 to get all your systems compliant with CMMC level 3. Is why it's stalled, because many small businesses, you know, that's just outside of reach. That's something they can't afford. So either they're going to have to lower the standards or help the market create accessible level 3 products. I've been in talks with a company that what they're trying to do is create a level 3 in a bubble. And so you connect to this virtual domain via a web page. That web page is totally segmented from the rest of your PC. So it's almost like a virtual tunnel via HTTPS into this virtual environment. And that virtual environment will be level 3 compliant. So then that company will just pay this other company for the access to the virtual environment.
Okay.
So that the result would be that we would be like digitalbeachhead.gov, and that would only exist in that little virtual environment.
Okay. Excellent. Now, focusing on is there any other areas in your product service you want to talk more about? Or
We do. We also do cyber training. We hook companies up with cyber awareness training so they can have a 12-month awareness training with phishing attempts, so they can, you know, really, because really the number one weakness is sadly ourselves. You know, people definitely like to click the links. So having more than a once a year Death by PowerPoint slideshow is always appropriate. So we offer that. And for companies that require a SIM, something to monitor their logging and look for alerts on their systems. Again, for small to medium-sized businesses, that's not really affordable to develop your in-house monitoring system. So we offer that as a third party, as a service. You just load an agent to your laptops or PCs or workstations, and then it goes to a 24/7 SOC that monitors all your networks. And that's as low as like $15 to $20 per box.
Okay, excellent. Now, to the SMB market here, what are some biggest threats they're facing in the SMB, the small and medium-sized business market? I mean, we all keep hearing about ransomware, but what is it within the ransomware threat variants that's the most disastrous to an SMB, or are there other threat vectors that they need to be aware of too?
I would say the biggest threat is phishing.
Really?
People hear ransomware, they hear, you know, being locked out and such. But ransomware is the product of an attack vector. It isn't the attack vector itself. So the attack vector meaning how did the malicious actors get into your network? And I don't think the majority of the time from the data I see that they're actually hacking, i.e. breaking into your network, trying to find loopholes in your network. the loophole they're looking for in your network is you. They're looking for someone to click a link, to open an attachment. And they're getting clever at it. It's no longer your French prince with the promise of $1 million in your, you know, in a bank, and you just have to give them $10,000 to get it. It is very much them sending a very convincing email. The training we do and the phishing exercises we do, they're typically coming from Amazon. Your package, sorry, we couldn't deliver your package. It's got an Amazon logo. You know, it looks legit. And so people are clicking those kinds of things. And we always say training, 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 train your users. But I think most people have the training as part of the user manual, you know, the employee's handbook, or a once-a-year death by PowerPoint. And if you talk to individuals, they would always say, yeah, I'm not going to fall victim to phishing. But like I say, they're getting more sophisticated. So it's really down to the user. I joke that a bunch of us IT guys should get together, cybersecurity guys, and create a band with our first song just being called Just One Click, because that's all it takes.
Okay. Wow, excellent. Now, is technology always the way to respond to a cyber threat for an SMB? I've always taken the approach, it's both a mixture of the human element and the technology element. You know, you need both to have that proactive mindset. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a cute meme that I put in some training slides when I'm talking to companies, and it says in this corner it's a little boxing ring, and in this corner you have your firewalls, your intrusion protection systems, your email filters, and in the other corner you have Dave. Dave's going to click the link and you're going to be messed about regardless. So for me, the technical side helps limit the scope of the attack. If you can filter out 90% of the bad emails, well, that's 90% that you don't have to worry about your employees clicking. But you have to also, in that same mindset, remember that you're not getting them all. They're always changing. So a certain percentage of emails are going to get through your filters. And then you have to have a trained workforce to know not to click and who to tell. And knowledge is power. And I think a lot of times in the cyber world, people just do the, well, I deleted that, which is excellent that they don't click on it. But we also have to educate them that they need to let someone know, because the IT department can know that there's a new flavor of phishing attack coming through. They can alert the workforce. They can make I agree 100%. It has to be a very good mix between what you have in technology and the human. But if we rely solely on technology, I think you're going to miss the boat. And for sure, people are going to always let us down. And it's because hackers and social engineering go to our better or worse angels within ourselves, help me, and they feel they need to help, or don't tell anyone, but you could win $1 million, you know, that kind of thing. So it's, they really prey on the human psyche.
Right. Now the $60,000 question, or question is, Mark or Mike, should you pay the ransom? I don't think one should pay the ransom. I think if you have backups in place, you use a cloud structure, I think that's good enough. In fact, a lot of insurance companies who offer a cybersecurity insurance plan, they're not even reimbursing, you know, SMBs if they pay a ransom. They're saying no more. I think the first company to do that was, I think, AXA Insurance from France, I think, if I'm correct. Should you pay the ransom? What's your thought on that?
Well, I think most organizations, we recently had a municipality here in Colorado that ended up paying $45,000 in ransom. And I think they do that because it's a business decision. And I am with you 100%. If you take the energy and effort up front to have appropriate backup plans, policies, procedures in place, you shouldn't be afraid of ransomware. You should be wary, you know, because regardless, if you have to go to a backup, you're going to be down for X amount of time. You know, that's always going to hurt an organization, a small business, especially. But you won't, you'll know you have a way out. You know, there's a ladder out of the hole. Where if you don't put that effort in up front and you hit with the ransomware, then it really is a business decision where you have to sit down and what's cheaper. Now, I like you, don't propose to pay the ransom because that's only going to drive them back to you, to others, you know, keep them in business. I think most ransomware organizations are very much business oriented. And that, what I mean by that is I'm sure they have a CRM, you know, a customer relations management database where they know, okay, we hit this municipality, they paid us $45,000. We won't hit them tomorrow because, you know, if we hit them tomorrow, they won't pay us again. They're just going to know that we're being greedy. But let's put a reminder that 6 months, 8 months out, let's hit them again, see if they fixed anything. So if you end up paying the ransom, I think you have to be forward-thinking enough, which is kind of an oxymoron because you've already been hit, so you really weren't forward-thinking. But post-hack forward-thinking enough to say, if we paid this ransom, we need to take immediate steps to figure this out so that we don't have to pay the ransom again. And again, I think that's education. We like to hold webinars for small to medium-sized businesses, just kind of educate them and say, hey, you know, use us, use someone else. It doesn't really matter, but definitely have a plan. You've got to have a disaster recovery plan. You have to have a backup plan. You have to know what to do when you've been hit, because the government's going to zero trust, which is basically assuming they're already in your network. I would say that small businesses should not be thinking about when or if they're going to be attacked. It should just be knowing, like a motorcyclist will say, you know, there's two types of motorcyclists, ones who haven't been in an accident yet and those that have. And it's always the yet. You know, it's not that they won't. Same thing, you know, I think hacks are coming. They're going to work through the ecosystem. So they're coming for us. So we have to prepare up front. But avoid paying at all possible, but I also understand the business decisions of a small business is when you do your cost analysis, if it's going to cost you $150,000 to get all your backups because you weren't really prepared, you don't really have them, and you've got to build stuff from scratch, and they're asking you for $40,000, it's a cheaper business decision to pay and get back operational. I just, you know, say that don't pay and then say, oof, you know, that was bad that happened to us, but thank God we're up. They really need to take the next step because trust and believe that those hackers are coming back for you.
Oh, yeah. Now, two side questions from this. Isn't it true that the Department of Treasury is making it like a form of treason if you do pay the ransom? And two, what's this new thing I've been hearing about, like a ransom negotiator?
The ransom negotiators are folks we haven't done that, but I do know someone that has done that for a company. And they are basically middlemen that are trying to help you reduce your cost on your ransom. Again, it goes back to that business decision. So if you're treating it as a business decision and it's a cost of doing business now, ransomware is a cost of doing business. There are people who are saying, hey, I will go out and I will try to get you a lower rate so that you can pay this ransom. I don't know how effective they are. I don't know if they're taking kickbacks or cuts, but I know they exist. And I do know you were talking about the Department of Treasury. I know that they are out there actually trying to find these Bitcoin wallets. That's usually where the ransomware goes. They've had some luck in capturing some, but the whole purpose of Bitcoin is that you can kind of hide it and move it, and it's hard to find a Bitcoin wallet if it's kept on a USB drive. So you know, they're having mixed luck in that arena.
But just because you pay the rents doesn't mean you're going to get those decryption algorithms, right? I mean, I believe in 90% of cases they just kind of run off. I think there are very, very few cyber attack groups that will actually give you the decryption algorithm. Am I right with that?
Typically, and what we're hearing is that some of the highest rated help desks are hackers, are these ransomware people, because they won't give you the algorithm. But they'll come in and decrypt your files. And very few of them are hitting you, getting paid, and not doing the follow-on of decrypting your stuff. They're actually decrypting your drives. And the reason they're doing that is because they want the next person to pay. It's sadly the word of mouth. They want the next business to know that, yeah, you know, it costs us 45, you know, think of Colorado and the municipalities talk. So when this one paid the $45,000, they're like, yeah, man, in 2 days, we got our stuff back up. And it would have taken us a month. So they want to have that good, and it's sad to say, customer relation for following through on their word. And again, because I think they're going to come back. So they're going to try to hit you again, and they want you to know, you know, that if you pay, you will get your files back as promised.
Interesting. Now, Mike, why is the perception with SMBs that cyber risk management has to be expensive? What causes that perception, and what can an SMB do to get a cost-affordable solution?
I think a lot of cybersecurity companies, you know, no fault to them. We're all businesses. We're all trying to earn a profit. But they have targeted the bigger companies with pen testing, penetration testing, vulnerability testing, kind of being this auditor that comes in. And the big folks pay more for their security. A financial institution is willing to really pay a lot to have us come in and do like a pen testing of their financial systems, a bank or, you know, a Pricewaterhouse or something like that. And so cybersecurity companies as a whole, that's where we've made our living. That's where most of the folks have made their living. And that's why I specifically wanted to target the small to medium-sized businesses, because I know they don't necessarily need that level of scrutiny. I joke that a coffee shop doesn't need to spend $10,000 for a firewall and a cyber, you know, intrusion detection system on their network, because they've got four teenagers and they're protecting a kiosk. It's not really worth it, you know? So I wanted to take what we had and kind of develop a piecemeal system. Again, like with pen testing. If you have a small business, say a manufacturing company with under 300 employees, you may need a pen test, but do you need a pen test now? Do I need to spend $15,000 as that company to come in and see where my holes are? A lot of folks, a lot of the people in the cyber world say, of course you do. My thought is, well, before we do that, before we even get to that level of conversation, I think of your home. If you want me to test the security of your house, but you leave your windows and doors open, why are you going to pay me $15,000 to come stand in your living room and say, yeah, your house is pretty wide open? Why don't we spend smaller amounts of money, take smaller steps, figure out that small, low-hanging fruit, those things you can do inexpensively to begin your cybersecurity journey. I often say we really shouldn't say cybersecurity, because we can't be secure. Things change too quick. There's no guarantees. If the government can get hacked and they're putting hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars into cybersecurity, what's a small business to do? You know, they're not going to be 100% protected. So what can you do? And it's cyber risk management. What risks can you fix? What risks can you not fix? Which ones, you know, can you program out and put money away for to fix? And so we kind of go in with that mindset is, you know, tell us where you are. Let's find out what we can do, you know, today, tomorrow, the next day. And let's build into a good cyber risk management program. So, you know, we can lock down some ports and protocols so we can train your employees. And to, if you have a budgetary, you know, restrictions that all of us small businesses do have, I mean, we're small businesses for a reason. You know, we want to be big, but we're not there yet. So what's your budget? What can we do? And then let's grow from there. Because doing something is better than doing nothing.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, Mike, as a writer, I've written a lot of articles on VCSOs, you know, for clients and, like, how to choose one, the benefits and so forth. But I don't think I've really written an article on, like, what the VCSO actually does. So what does the VCSO do?
That's a great question because we get asked that all the time. You want to be our VCSO. What do I do? And that's why I kind of enjoy that we're offering the virtual CISO. I think if you are a small to mid-sized business, your VCSO is not a full-time job. The main purpose of a VCSO or a CISO in general is to set your cyber strategy, your long-term goals, to develop what kind of IT systems you need, what kind of security stuff you need to help develop written policies that a company would need in that cyber realm. So a typical CISO would sit with your CEO, CTOs, you know, your C-level executives, and kind of just oversee your security aspects from a cyber standpoint. Of course, when we think cyber, most people just think the bits, but a good cyber person also thinks about physical security, personnel security, how do we hire people? How do we outprocess people from our company when, you know, they've been either let go or terminated and those kind of things. So that's kind of the high level what a CISO does. What we like to offer with the CISO is that level of understanding. We also will create your policies for you. We will run your scans, your pen tests, you know, anything you need in that regard. We'll hook you up with the SIM. So we really become your go-to cyber person, but you're not paying for that 24/7 guy sitting down the hall, taking up an office, costing you an arm and a leg to be there, you know, full time, when really, as a small to medium-sized business, once we've set up your policy, once we've kind of got you going down that path of cyber risk management, it's keeping up. It's looking for new technology. And this is, again, why it's customizable, but there's a certain number of hours a week or a month that you may need to have those services that you don't necessarily need to have someone on call or on staff, I should say, all the time. We're there when you need us, and we're not there draining your resources when you don't.
Okay, excellent. Now, Mike, as we come into the second part of our show here, there's some hot-button issues in the world of cybersecurity I kind of want to touch on, which I get asked quite a bit, and I've written about two before. So the first one is the Internet of Things. Now, it's called, IoT. I don't like it. I think it's a very scary proposition to have everything all connected together. It just leaves more, you know, room for the cyber attacker. I mean, I still drive an 03 Honda Civic, the old analog, you know, instrumented car. I've seen cars where they have, like, three computers, and it's like James Bond, okay? And I've seen things like smart home where you clap your hands, coffee maker turns on. I mean, do we really need all this? I mean, do you have a smart home or a smart car? I mean, what are your thoughts on all this? That thing is too much.
Well, I think the problem, calling it the Internet of Things, I think is misleading, because then you think, well, I have an IoT device and my laptop. Well, your laptop's also an IoT device. You know what I mean? It's know that if it has an IP address, or what people would call this IoT device, it's on your network. It is communicating with every computer. It's there. It's a risk. And like you, everything is, you know, now connected. It's a scary prospect. My my biggest concern is most IoT devices are built and designed so that an average non-IT trained user, i.e. my parents, plug it into their home network and it works, you know? The problem with that is they're using default passwords, default logins, that they don't know what a firmware update is or why it's important, you know, anything like that. And so I wish that our internet service providers, in an effort to improve their own security, would work with these IoT device providers to segment them on a separate, it's easy to set up a subnet for, a, say, Comcast to say, hey, out of your Wi-Fi, connect to this one for IoT and this one for home, so that people could then segment that stuff out, and it's just the IoT world that's kind of at risk to itself versus everybody's home network. You can do that yourself, of course, but again, I think of my parents, you know, they're in their 70s, so if they buy, you know, Alexa, they plug it in, they kind of read the instructions, get Alexa to talk back to them, and they're like, awesome, and they forget it. You know what I mean? They don't know anything about security beyond that.
Right.
So, okay. Yeah, I think IoT, I brief that a lot in my briefings, that your IoT devices are a exponential risk. And there's a website called Shodan.io, and that'll show you every webcam in the world that's open.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
So it's an IoT site, and they'll tell you other things, but, yeah.
That's scary. Okay, well, I don't think we'll go there on that one. But, okay, the next one is artificial intelligence. I just wrote a book on that. It came out in print, I think, last February, March. And AI, you know, as we know, you're trying to mimic the thought and behavioral process of the human brain, so forth, and the reasoning powers behind it. But in my view, I think AI is a badly misused term. It's just thrown about more for marketing purposes. Nobody really understands it in cyber. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree. I think there's AI, and then there's something that is more I don't know how I would term it, but to me, AI means a computer should be able to learn new behaviors on its own, non-programmed. If you have what a lot of people are calling AI now, are still restricted to the parameters of what the programmer put in. So it comes with bias. And we know it's right now racially biased, sexually biased. Because your typical white male is what's creating AI, and that's not going to work. You have to be able to think for all communities, all races, all different nationalities if you're going to develop a true AI, something that can, you know, develop new code based on stuff it's learned. I think today AI is more code that people have thought of and has predictable responses based on what you've inputted. There's some quote-unquote learning, but again, I think that's still limited to lines of code, if-then kind of things, and we really need to expand on that if we want to have true AI. Back in the 90s, I talked with the computer scientist at the Air Force. And this is pre-drones, and he was discussing the idea of having drones. And the only thing stopping us at that point was bandwidth. You know, we couldn't get the signal to the drone in time to, like, lift up if there's a mountain coming kind of thing. You know, the delay was too long, the lag was too long. Once we solved that issue, you know, now we have drones. Well, at that time, I had mentioned, I said, you know, if we could create some sort of quote-unquote AI that when pilots are in their planes and they're in combat and it receives damage, that the plane learns, oh, I I have a hole in my right wing. It's causing drag. And the pilot doesn't have to do anything because the computer on board gives him level stick at all times, regardless. So he's not fighting against the damage to the plane. The computer does that on its own, so he's always flying level stick. That was what we considered AI back then. But even that was, it wasn't learning. It was what we would program into the computer. So my fear is AI, and then going back to your IoT, what happens when my refrigerator says I'm not opening, or I'm going to turn my I'm mad at you, so, you know, I'm cranking this up or freezing all your milk, you know? Terminator type stuff. Maybe I'm paranoid, but, you know, I don't know if we want to get to a point where we have true AI.
Well, I mean, in my, I guess, I'm a Joe, I mean, my dad was a professor at Purdue, and I'm actually from West Lafayette. And he was actually involved in neural transplantation research, and he was doing work in spinal cord regeneration research. And he said, we will never understand the human brain, or only like maybe just even one-tenth of even that to understanding anything about it. So I don't think we'll ever really understand the human brain. And it just, it kind of bothers me when you hear all these biometric vendors saying, yes, oh, yeah, it's got AI embedded into it, you know. You don't have anything to worry about, and, and of course the SMB already all excited. Oh, it's an AI tool, you know, but there's really nothing of AI in there to begin with. So, anyway, just my little soap.
No, I'm with you. I think true AI is when the computer thinks for itself.
Right.
The computer simulates thinking for itself based on your programming that you've put in, so it still thinks for itself with all your bias.
Right. I mean, it takes a lot of high-level statistical algorithms, and it takes a lot of data. I mean, you're talking like, you know, probably terabytes and petabytes of data just for a thing to learn something. I mean, it's basically garbage in, garbage out, but it's going to have to inhale a lot of, you know, garbage in first before it can do anything. And secondly, you got to make sure that those data sets are optimized, right? I mean, you can't put in bad data because your whole outcome will be skewed, but... Anyway.
Absolutely. So, and that's why I say, like, they'll say AI is in your intrusion detection system, because if it sees a pattern of new, you know, signatures come through, it'll say, oh, I need to block that. Well, it didn't think that. You've programmed in to look for this, and if this happens, then do this. It's just a very, I mean, it's more complicated than that, but it's, the computer isn't actually sitting there going like, huh, I wonder what I'll do today.
Right. Now, the next thing I want to ask my
and I agree. I agree with you too, though, sir. Sorry to break, but I agree with you too that if we can't understand our own brain, how are we gonna, you know, how are we gonna develop another one?
That's a good point. I should put that in my book. Anyway, I'll put that in the second version that comes up. But anyway, the next one. Well, if you want to co-author that one with me, Mike, I'd love to have you. No, but anyway, in all seriousness, the next thing is cybersecurity insurance. Now, nobody really cared, you know, two squats about it before, but now with all this ransomware stuff, it's starting to, you know, really take the limelight now. And at business things, just because, oh, we have cybersecurity insurance, we don't have to, you know, worry about anything. If we get hit, we'll get paid for it. That's far from the case, right? I mean, these insurance companies are really scrutinizing applicants, right, just to make sure they're not too much of a risk. Am I correct in that, or have you ever dealt with cybersecurity insurance?
Yes, I did. With our CISO offerings, we often work with the cyber insurance company, with the business, with their cyber insurance company, or whoever's providing them insurance in the cyber side. I think, like all businesses, insurance companies came out and were like, this is awesome. We can add on another $5 a month, $10 a month, and we'll tell them we're going to offer them $1 million in cybersecurity coverage. Because they didn't understand it either. And they were making $5, $10 a month from, you know, millions of customers. And the customers were like, cool, I'm covered. Everything was great. Then people were really starting to get hacked. You know, they stopped going after just the big boys. They were hitting the small to mid-sized businesses. You know, they were hitting pipelines now, as we know, those kind of things. And these cyber insurance companies or these insurance companies that held the cyber policies were like, oh, crap, we got to pay them $1 million or up to $1 million for, you know, this coverage. So as with any business, they decide we need to take a second look at this. This isn't just a quick and easy moneymaker and not a lot of people are going to get hacked. Lots of people are being hacked. We have to revisit our standards. And I predicted this for a while. I said, you know, knowing insurance companies, I have car insurance, and if I drive into a tree, they'll, as long as I was driving safe, have a seatbelt on, and I just, it was an accident, quote-unquote accident, then they'll pay to help fix my car. If the police show up and I am teetotal drunk, the insurance company is going to say, sorry, that's not covered. You didn't take due diligence to protect yourself and your vehicle. Well, now they're doing that in the cyber world. They're kind of getting smart and saying like, hey, we can't just say, hey, for $5, we'll give you $1 million and be happy that we're making an extra $5 and we'll never have to pay. They're realizing they're going to have to start to pay, which then they come back and now are requiring companies, a company I work with, they recently wanted to have some a questionnaire filled out. And one of the questions was, are you monitoring administrative activities on your network and taking action if you see unknown or unpredicted or, you know, anomalous admin activities on your network? And, you know, the company came to me and said, we don't know. Are we doing that? You know, and so then that's like we go in, we look at the SIMs, we look at their rule sets, you know, to determine if they're doing that. But that's a long way from the insurance company just saying, like, yeah, for an extra $10, we can pop this rider on and we'll cover you for $1 million. So I think that's only going to get worse, you know, the more hacks that are out there. Insurance companies, I think we all, as having lived through different kinds of insurance, medical, car, the last thing they want to do is pay. If they can find an excuse not to pay out, they'll find it. And so a company not taking any due diligence for their cybersecurity is going to be the quickest way for them to not get paid their cyber insurance payouts. So I recommend that companies document it. Yes, go ahead.
So in a way, I mean, the insurance companies are going to become like auditors themselves too, right, in a different way?
Yeah. Yeah, and we've had insurance companies get a hold of us and have said, hey, you know, we offer cyber insurance for these folks, and we've asked them to get a hold of you to kind of just give them a quick cyber audit so that we all know where they're at. And that helps set their fee. Some insurance companies now are going to begin offering discounts if you've had, you know, a cyber audit done versus not. But I think I think the discounts will be short-lived, and it'll be more just requirements. To get insurance, you need this. You know, and if you don't want to do an audit or you haven't done it or you can't prove, you either will be denied coverage or you'll have to pay, you know, an exorbitant amount.
Okay. Well, the next big thing I want to talk about is COVID and the remote workforce. I mean, nobody thought that this would happen. Now we're seeing things kind of, you know, getting back to normal. Now there's talk about the Delta variant coming out, things being locked down again. How has COVID impacted you, your business, your clients, and what do you think about it? I mean, I have my views on it. I'm not afraid to say it. I think personally it was a lab experiment that went bad in China. I don't buy the argument that came from the meat markets. I mean, my parents were from India. I visited India, and they've got the same kind of meat markets. You know, and I never got sick. So what are your thoughts on all this whole thing with COVID? I mean, we get a whole podcast, but, you know.
I think I'm with you. I'm unsure. Really, I've lived around the world. I've been in, you know, third world countries. I've been to Pakistan, Afghanistan, you know. I've seen the... I used to joke with friends that I was in a market in Abu Dhabi, and I swear when we would go get our shawarmas, they would, you know, move their hand to get the bugs off the produce before they put it on top of the meat, you know. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I was like you. If you're new, you know, like the first time I'm there, I'd get, you know, the typical travel bug, you know, and be on the toilet or whatever. But after a while, you don't, you know what I mean? Your body gets accustomed to that new bacteria that are going around, and you're good to go, you know? And I think that makes that it came from an animal, not necessarily impossible, but, you know, it opens the door to me to other possibilities. Who knows? And I don't know if we'll ever know, you know, because, again, when you're talking about a third world country, or not a third world country, but a country that is very restrictive in what information they let out, as China is, you probably will never really know. But it has affected businesses, and I think more effects are coming. I don't think we've realized the full effects yet. With the government stepping in and putting moratoriums on like housing and evictions and people getting some extra cash in their pockets to get by, which is all needed. But that's going to come to an end at some point, right? We always got to come to an end of those kind of programs. And when that happens, then there's going to be a lot of people, I think, hurting and out and about. So, you know, I got my shots. I hope everyone gets their shots. I know it's a personal decision, but I'm thinking I'm doing it not necessarily for me, although part of it is for me, but that's my decision to make for me doing it for me. But I'm also doing it for the older folks I see in the grocery store who maybe didn't. I don't want to get them sick. But that's just my choice, and I did that knowing that I did 20 years in the military where I had no choice with respect to my body, and I've had anthrax shots, and I've had, you know, typhoid shots. So I figured my body's already got all the crap in it. A little more. Is it going to hurt me? I might as well go and get her done. So right. That helped me in my personal decision. You know what I mean? I know everyone else has their own. From a work standpoint, we have had a lot more people working from home. And to me, that goes right back to our IoT. I talk to companies, and I said, I've talked to CEOs who are working from home, and I'm like, so how is it now that your children are part of your corporate network? And they're always like, what do you mean? I'm like, how are you segmenting your laptop now that you're home from everybody else at home? And they're like, well, I'm not. Well, now your kid's in the basement playing Xbox and, you know, doing who knows what on their laptops and your refrigerator and your Alexa and your thermostat, whatever you have in your smart home, are now all part of your corporate network. Congratulations. What are you doing to protect yourself? And they're just going, you know, I don't think people understand that ability.
Yeah, the last hot button issue I want to talk to you about are the data privacy laws, the GDPR and the CCPA most especially. Do you deal with those for clients also, or your clientele really don't fall under the thresholds of being have to be compliant by those laws? Can you hear me now, Mike?
I can hear you. For some reason, I got disconnected from the number.
No worries. Well, as I was saying, the last issue I want to talk about before we wrap up our podcast are those of data privacy laws, like the GDPR and the CCPA. Have you had to deal with those for clients, or do the SMBs don't even have to worry about falling under the thresholds of have to be audited or being compliant by that?
We do. I talk a lot with folks about the privacy laws. Specifically, in the United States, we don't really have a national one. And so I let them know that they need to be wary. You have to be wary because realistically, it's based on the customer's location, not your location. So I'm a Colorado company, and a lot of people think, well, that's okay. I'm going to follow my Colorado privacy law, and I'm good. And I'm like, well, do you have a customer in California? Then you have to follow the California law. Do you have one in New York? You got to follow the New York law. Or, like you say, GDPR, do you have any customers who live in the EU? If so, you have to follow GDPR. I think an SMB is much less at risk for an audit and, you know, really being hit for it. But if it happens, you know, those types of fines and responsibilities for recovery on that will put someone out of business. I tell my small to medium-sized business customers, think about getting someone an ID protection. If you have an ID protection, say LifeLock, $20 to $25 a month, you know, per user for 3 years. That's a lot to put out. And that's like typically a minimum requirement for most states to provide anyone's data you lost 3 years of some sort of ID protection. So can you afford that? You know, and can a small business afford that? So those are the things I tell them to kind of keep an eye out for and keep, you know, to think about when it comes to privacy laws. I don't know if we'll all follow all of them. You know, it's that's onerous for a small business. But I highly recommend encryption, because most privacy laws, if the data is encrypted and you don't lose your key, you're kind of protected from all of those onerous fines and that kind of stuff for having encrypted data. And a lot of times small businesses, that's the first time they've heard the word encryption.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Now, as we wrap up our show, Mike, how do you think the rest of the year, now that we're halfway through the year, a little bit more, how do you think the threat landscape is going to look like this year and perhaps even going into early next year? And what do you tell people to mitigate the risk of being hacked into? Now, we all are at risk of becoming a victim, but how can we lessen those chances?
Yeah, I would say I think the threat landscape is going to continue to be that phishing and ransomware. That's kind of like the hack du jour at the moment. I do think we're going to see more nation state activity in that, not just the Nigerians or the, you know, kid in a basement kind of thing. You know, you're going to see some serious nation state ransomware to collect money. My guess would be continued from the Soviet Union or Russia now, and probably North Korea, and possibly some other states. So what to do about it? Number one is know that it exists and don't ignore it. You know, the first thing is to admit I have a problem. So we have a cyber problem, and we need to do something about it. So set up a cyber risk management program. And that doesn't mean spend lots of money. That means sit down and figure out, what do I think my risks are? For a small business, I have 12 people with email, so I got to watch and train my employees because they're going to get emails, and I don't want them to do something inappropriate or, you know, unbeknownst to them that causes damage to the company. Passwords. Are we all using strong passwords? Do we have a good password policy? Let's hit that. Maybe get a password manager. They're low cost. Can we afford, if we're using like Comcast or CenturyLink or some sort of direct business router, and that's our only device to protect, maybe we invest in getting a Cisco or a Linksys or some other router/firewall device between. You know, you can get them for under $500 now. So take those little steps as a small to mid-sized business, and like what I just said would cost you under $1,000 totally, and you would already be aware. You know, you don't need that. That's without any cyber company input. You know, you can sit down and do that tomorrow. The key then would be, if you want to engage a cyber company, they can help you develop a better firewall rules, you know, so you don't just have a firewall in place because it doesn't do much for you. If you just buy it and plug it in, you got to, you know, configure it to help you protect your network. But the first step would always be know your risk. Sit down and figure out where you think your risks are, and then find a plan to slowly but surely start addressing them.
Okay, excellent. Now, Mike, our final question is, suppose we have someone from our audience or someone to reach out to you, what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you?
The best way is if you go to our website, which is www.digitalbeachhead.com. There's two H's, beach and head. Some people miss that, so it's digitalbeachhead.com. And we have a contact us link out on there. Or you can reach out to info@digitalbeachhead.com and send us an email, and we'll be happy to get back with you. And we're happy to just answer some simple questions. You know, we don't charge everyone for a simple answer to a simple question. So we're here to help.
Sounds great, Mike. Excellent. I'm so glad your company's focused on the SMB market. Now, hopefully with the show, you know, we'll get some interest stirred up for you so you can help go out and help them. And hopefully they can get away from the mindset that it's too expensive when it's really not that expensive. So, but anyway, thanks for your time, Mike, and we look forward to having you again on a future podcast.
Perfect. I appreciate talking with you.